Welcome all to the second episode of the Contemporary Film Directors Podcast. I'm Justice Neeland, one of the co-editors of CFD. I'm delighted today to be joined by my fab new series co-editors, Josh Umeby and Sarah Keller. So we're delighted to be joined today by Joe Jun, the author of the new book, Bong Joon-ho, Global Entanglements, which is one of the latest releases in CFD. And I'll just say a few quick words of introduction to Joe. Joe has vast and impressive interdisciplinary research interests that I'm not going to be able to encompass the entirety of. But I'll just quickly say Joe is a university professor of English in the School of Humanities at University of California, Irvine, and also more recently, director of UCI's Center for Critical Korean Studies. Joe's scholarship focuses on Asian and Asian American literature, film, and media. And Joe's most recent book prior to this Bong volume is titled Vicious Circuits: Korea's IMF Cinema and the End of the American Century, a truly terrific book that was published by Stanford UP in their Post 45 series in 2019. So I'll just quickly say, Jen Fay and I had wanted a book in the CFD series on Bong for a long time, in part because, if memory serves, we were huge fans of The Host. And a few years after that film came out, I had a chance to read Joe's terrific article on Memories of Murder that appeared in Cinema Journal, now Journal of Cinema and Media Studies. And so several years ago, Jen and Joe and I began a conversation about the possibility of a Bong volume. And we needed to find the right time for Joe to be in a place to write the book. And I'm so happy that Joe decided to stick with us and at the end of the day to deliver such a wonderful book. So this was also, of course, contracted and written before Josh and Sarah came on as co-editors. And so it's my understanding they had the pleasure of reading a good chunk of this book very recently for the first time. And I'm sure they'll be happy to jump into the conversation as we go. So, Joe, I thought maybe we would just start by learning a little bit more about how you came to this particular project, and maybe more specifically, how some of the things that you're thinking about in the Bong book. Some of those things are connected to some of your other recent scholarly work.
Great. Well, first of all, thank you, Justice, for the lovely introduction. And I didn't realize I was this is the second in the series, the second podcast. Whoa. Just, everything went blank for a second. The second in the series, so I'm really honored for that. And kind of appropriate. Bong Joon-ho has this weird obsession with second place. Like in Parasite, there's this at there's in the basement, the kind of altar thing. There's like a bunch of second place Olympic silver medalists, even though Korea has plenty of first place. So second place is somehow perfect for me. In terms of the genesis of the project, there's a kind of long genesis and a shorter one. The long one is I happened to be present in 2003 for the U.S. premiere of Memories of Murder, which just happened to be at the San Diego Asian Film Festival, where I was a juror that year. My first job was at the University of San Diego, and I just sort of walked into the movie not really knowing who Bong Joon-ho was, and just sort of being floored by the movie, and frankly quite astonished. And I immediately found, I think he only had one other film at the time, but I've been following his career ever since, and he's been very, one of my favorite directors. And secondly, as you mentioned, the other shorter genesis is that you asked me to write this book. So, and I remember there's a lovely dinner. I actually wrote about this in the acknowledgments,
Yeah, no.
a lovely dinner in Toronto in 2018, where you and Jen Fay and Danny Nassett, the Illinois general editor, had a lovely dinner. And I remember thinking, I told you at the time that, I think Okja had just come out, and it didn't feel like a book yet. And honestly, I said that I would be interested, but I wanted to wait. And honestly, I thought we were going to wait for a long time, like, maybe a few more movies, a few more films, maybe a decade. I have no idea. At the time, I had no idea. But obviously, Parasite came out, I think the next year after that, and then I could really see a kind of arc throughout his career that would be, I think, interesting and robust enough to write a book about. In terms of you Justice mentioned my previous book, Vicious Circuits, Kurizaimov's Cinema: The End of the American Century, and there's a couple chapters that deal with Bong in that volume. And basically, what I've been kind of thinking about, and this book is kind of helped me think about since Vicious Circuits, but now in these projects that I'm working on now, is I think his work is really useful for helping us think through the complexities of globalization, and particularly at a moment where the kind of regime of globalization, thinking of, sort of rise of these sort of fascist right-wing politicians, where that, is really kind of changing into morphing into something else. And so so in terms of his own career, I think there's an interesting arc. But I think it's an arc that also traces a larger kind of geopolitical and historical arc that I think is out, obviously incredibly relevant today. I think I spend incredible, depressingly long periods of time doom scrolling these days about, what's going on in Washington. I think that Bong's films give us kind of insight into sort of how we got here in a kind of roundabout way.
I want to come to those insights in a moment because I mean you play them out so thoughtfully and elegantly over the course of the book. But I wonder, I mean, it seems like the specific format of the CFD series could be seen to impose a certain kind of shape on an approach to a body of work, and that shape is a little bit different than the shape of a book like Vicious Circuits. And I wonder. I mean, I know that there's Bong material in the Vicious Circuits book, but if there was something about the particular format of this kind of series, as you thought about it, that maybe allowed you to work a little bit differently or to approach different aspects of Bong's work than you did in that volume. Because obviously you're working with a much more sort of obviously auteurist frame.
I mean, I think the one thing that it allowed me to do was think about, I mean, because you're thinking about the trajectory of a career, it helped me think about historical trajectories in a very systematic way, right? And I think, I actually, one of the initial ideas I had about the book, which was in somewhat ways corrected when I interviewed him for the interview that appears in the volume, was as a kind of moving from a kind of local orientation to a kind of global one, and then Parasite being a sort of synthesis between that. I think that turned out to be overly simplistic, but at least that was the kind of that was the way I kind of got my head around the idea. And I think his work is kind of uniquely, maybe uniquely is overstated, but it's suited to that kind of thinking. One of the things I asked him about in the interview, and the sort of detail that sticks with me the whole time that makes me think about the sort of organization of the series, was a story he told me about how it was a question about maps, and like there's a lot of maps in his movies and why he likes maps. And he told me that, this one day he took, I think it was Parasite, the script of Parasite, and put it on the floor and sort of looked at it from afar, because he kind of wanted to see it, at scale, right?
Yeah, you talk about the bird's eye perspective, right?
Yeah, and it's an interesting story for two reasons. On the one hand, it's a sort of like, I don't know, there's a kind of autorial gesture there, right? The sort of like mastery, the desire to kind of see it all. But it's a kind of autorial mastery that is like absurd in its very premise, right? This is about the impossibility. I mean, that the fact that you see it all means in that case that you see nothing, right? That it's actually You know, it doesn't, it's not a clarifying view. It's a kind of, I think he himself called it a silly or stupid thing to do. And I think that, like, I guess that's the way I think of his films, the kind of work that his films do, in terms of thinking about globalization, which is also a kind of absurd, like impossible project to kind of see this sort of large system and how it functions. But you know, that it's always kind of going back and forth between those two poles.
Yeah, I mean that's so good. And this gets to one of the things I wanted to ask about, which is how you navigate in the book this kind of scalar play between these deeply quotidian, you use the term local often, or even banal details, and then this much larger scale of, political economic forces or frames, and that sort of oscillation between the local or the global, the banal and the kind of political economic system seems to be
Yeah.
like an essential dynamic to your analysis of Wong's work. And I wonder if you could just give us maybe a few examples of how we see that oscillation or play in a couple of films.
Sure. I mean, I think of the local and I'm just rereading for this new book that I'm working on. I'm just rereading Koichi Iwaguchi's famous book, Recentering Globalization. And you know, this has actually helped me think about this kind of local and global question. If that book is written in 2000, published in 2002, sort of, you know, amidst those debates about like who can forget the portmanteau local, right? And it's, you know, situated in those kinds of debates that people were having about globalization at the time. But the thing that's really useful, the thing that was really useful for me in thinking in relation to Bong Joon-ho's work is that these things aren't like opposites, right? That we can think of them as part of a broader continuum. And if there is an opposite to the local or the global in Bong Joon-ho's work, it's the individual. So the local and global aren't, you know, opposite sort of ideas. It's the individual versus the social. And this is kind of why I started the book with Mother and that scene in the jail scene, is because the realization of that scene is the realization of the fact that one is immersed in social relations, no matter how much wants to kind of withdraw from them. The other example I think would be Barking Dogs Never Bite, this first film, which is all about, you know, this character, this main character, who's a you know, failing humanities graduate student, and it's all about it's about how he's constantly surprised by the fact that he's immersed in a social network. Right, that he lives in a community and that to which he is responsible and beholden to in various kinds of ways, in the way all of us kind of are. But what's amazing about that film is that it always sort of comes as a surprise and a shock that he desperately kind of wishes to remain siloed. I mean, it's a film about an apartment, right? Living in an apartment, right? And it's the desire to like be to have privacy, to remain, you know, whether that's privacy, you know, freedom from nuisance of noise of dogs barking, or a more kind of profound kind of privacy of sort of consciousness, right? And so I think the jail scene in Mother reminds us that that's a kind of impossibility, right? That those kinds of desires are always, you know, in Mother they're criminal, right? And they have horrific effects. Particularly for the innocent. And I hadn't thought about it. I was just in London and I saw one of my favorite paintings ever is the Edouard Manet's the Bar Folie Bergère, the woman standing at the bar. And you know you see in the reflection that she's a barmaid and she's, you know, serving a customer. And the viewer of the painting is in the position of the customer. It's this weird kind of angular play that for a long time people thought it was impossible. I think Jeff Wall actually showed like through photography how it actually was possible. But the connection I want to make though, between that shot of the mother sitting looking through the plexiglass, it's a very similar shot where the back of the innocent man's head is in the foreground, the police is in the background. And then you get the sort of plexiglass screen. Like they both the Monet painting and that shot both suggest like this sort of inevitability of mediation, right? And it's a kind of mediation in Manet for the mediation of painting. It's a sort of like a the sort of mediation of the medium. But it's also a kind of social the inevitability of a kind of social immersion. And those two things are actually collapsed into one. And for Bong, I think it's the cinema that really like makes that happen and makes that kind of inevitable. So the example that I keep that the simplest example is Barking Dogs Never Bite. But I mean, you can see it kind of everywhere throughout a cinema, right? That these characters who are really kind of happy and comfortable and want to be to remain, where they are sort of. There's a the wonderful scene in Memories of Murder where the mentally disabled boy who is sort of suspected improperly of the crime. They're talking about him in a restaurant, and he's like falls out of this closet, and he's just sort of he sort of like emerges. It's almost like the sort of Shakespearean kind of pratfall moment. But it's sort of like it's a sort of another instance of the sort of character that wants to kind of remain independent and separate from the world of serial killers and murder that's sort of that's invaded this town and so forth. But it's just sort of impossible. And you see that kind of over and over again, these kind of characters that are pulled into networks. And those networks eventually they begin as communities, right? The small town, police, but they become like in later films, in Okja, they become, global supply chains, right? And that there's a continuity between just the fact of social responsibility in a film like Mother and the global supply chain in as is expressed in Okja.
Well, this is helping me too to think about a connection between where you started this sequence in Mother and the way in Bong's work the characters are always finding themselves embedded in scenes of social relation, but also finding themselves embedded in other frames of determination as directly connected to how you want us to approach Bong's mise-en-scène and get us thinking about what is distinctive about Bong Joon-ho as a master of mise-en-scène and someone who has such a high degree of kind of design intensity around spatial articulation in his film. So I wonder, I mean, these are, and just for listeners, one of the things that we're always encouraging writers for the series to do is to come at any given director's work with some clear sort of conceptual innovations and edges. And Joe, I think, one of what I see the innovations of this book is to sort of rethink mise-en-scène in a almost in a sort of political economic frame. And you're doing that by putting mise-en-scène in dialogue with another term, mise-en-abîme. So could you just talk us through a little bit that sort of conceptual nexus of those two terms and how they're working in Bong's work?
Well, first of all, thank you for putting that in a really smart formulation. I'm actually one of the sort of regrets too strong, but one of the things I've sort of thought about, one of the points of potential embarrassment for me with this book is that I really, with mise-en-scène in a book about film directors, is such a, common, idea and concept in film studies that it doesn't require, the sort of explication that I kind of give it in the book. And that's been a source of sort of some retrospective embarrassment for me. But the reason why I did that and is for two reasons. One, that I really think that Bong's work is thinking kind of like at that pace about mise-en-scène, like what is it? Like what does it mean to situate? What is it? How do stories follow from their placement? Right? Like what is placement? Right? And so initially, I had a kind of very crude formulation. I was thinking, okay, mise en scène is like the local, and mise en abîme is the global. And that just didn't seem right. And what I sort of settled upon is that they're both, I mean, mise is placement, placing, right, in scene or placing on stage. That what both mise en scène and mise en abîme allow for is a certain strategies and tools for placement that allow for very particular articulations of space, right? Which then makes the idea, the sort of film art, contiguous with geography, right? So these kinds of, they're just strategies of spatial articulation that connect, therefore, like, what a room looks like and what it feels like, the classic sort of mise en scène questions in film art, to political economic questions of what, the world feels like, and to actually place them on a similar continuum. They do it in slightly different ways, right? Mise en scène is more about particularity. So the example that I thought of that I wanted to bring here is just, it's pretty obvious, but the house in Parasite, and it's like the train in Snowpiercer or the apartment in Barking Dogs Never Bite, in the sense that the stories really follow from the place, right? In some ways, the story is the place, like particularly in Snowpiercer, just moving through the train is literally the structure of the story. So the house in Parasite, so is a useful place. But I was thinking actually specifically, and this is where I kind of end the book, the house as it's expressed at the very end of the film, where Kiwoo, the son of the poor family, is on the hillside looking down at the house through binoculars, and his father is doing the sort of Morse code through the light. And there's a German family inside the house, right? And so it's this house is moved from, earlier on, I think it was understood as a kind of game space, right? This sort of like in the first half of the first hour of the film is a kind of almost like a caper, right? It's sort of a logistical caper. It's really fun and comedic.
Kind of a heist.
Yeah, exactly. It's a kind of heist film. And then by the end, the house takes on a totally different register. And that placement of the German family inside the house, with the Korean son up on the hillside, is this, opens up these questions about it's both kind of mise en scène in terms of these strategies of placement, but also has that kind of self-reflexivity of mise en abîme. That is, like, we're looking at the house, like we're sort of looking at this thing that we've been preoccupied with for the duration of the movie, and we're sort of reflecting on what it means that, like, the Korean guy is outside and the German guy is inside. Whether that's about, resonates with sort of long history of colonial occupation in Korea, or if it's about, industry. Like, what does it mean to, is it a Korean movie anymore if there's no Korean actors in it? Which is, like, a question I think begged by his subsequent film, Mickey 17, which actually has no Korean actor. That has Steve Yeun as the sort of diaspora Korean actor, but otherwise lacks. It's a Warner Brothers film, so it's a different. So it's I think of that house as being sort of helps us think through those kinds of questions, right? And so we go from, radically from, like, what kind of place is this, to, what does it mean, like, what kind of world is being sort of explicated. The other thing I just want to point out about that scene that I just find incredibly endlessly fascinating, and this I did write about, is the sort of heterochronic quality that the snow keeps falling, and there's a cut inside the house but not outside the house, and so they subtly shift different time frames. And this isn't in the book, but I was writing about this for this other project that I'm working on. I went back to the initial scene, not the initial scene, the scene where they're celebrating. The family celebrating their success, and duping the parks and getting jobs. And there's a drunk outside of their, basement apartment, and he's urinating, and Kiwoo goes out to, make him stop and pour water. And the daughter, Kijung, holds up her phone to film it. And I didn't realize this until I just watched this, like, for the billionth time. But she records in slow motion, right? Which is, we know from, our friend, our mutual friend Mark Goebel's work, is impossible, right? You can't record in slow motion. Slow motion is, capturing many different frames and then playing it, at a different pace, right? But she records in slow motion, the sort of, and there's all of these sort of examples of like the sort of heterochronic that happen throughout the film. And I think, again, it kind of gets back to this. I think for me, the heterochronic goes with the kind of the zone of being, right? It has these various different techniques of getting us to step outside, to see the play within the play, to kind of these mom access these moments of self-reflexivity that help us think about the larger structure and the relationship between the specificity and particulars to these kinds of larger structures, whether they're global systems or industry or whatever, or cultural.
Yeah, well, that brings us, I think, really neatly to the question of allegory, and I'm really curious, Joe, to hear you say a little bit about your allegorical method. I mean, I see immediately how your reading of mise-en-scène and mise-en-abîme opens up such a rich terrain of allegorical interpretation. I also think it's true, and you acknowledge this at different points in the book, that in many ways some of these films are sort of tailor-made for allegorical readings. There's a kind of almost a prepackaged allegorical reading available through the monster allegory in The Host or the class allegory in Snowpiercer. And so I'm wondering how you, because you do, manage to kind of get beyond the gravitational pull of the kind of inbuilt allegories themselves and to something that seems so new and original in the readings.
Oh, thank you. This is a hard question for me because, as a method, I mean, allegory kind of risks embarrassment, right? I mean, there's a kind of programmatic, color by numbers quality to allegory that is kind of embarrassing if you think of yourself as a good, critic. So, I mean, I think of allegory here not as a structure, not exactly as a structure of kind of formal correspondence that either stages like a moral, like I'm thinking of, Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, like really old allegory, like a sort of moral drama, or maybe, in the manner of like, Alexander Pope, something satirical, right? Where it's, the it's a play on correspondence, right? It generates these kinds of like positions that you can take vis-a-vis the characters and who they stand for. And I want to think of it. I try to think of allegory more generally as provisional form, like a kind of provisional form that affords a kind of wider degree of contemplation around a set of ideas beyond the fact of correspondence. And this is the, that's really abstract and this is, but I mean, this is like the classic, maybe too obvious example is Plato's Allegory of the Cave, right? Which is less about, like who the people are, how they correspond to, actual people or whatever, and more about kind of the nature of representation. And obviously, it's been, used in film studies as about the kind of nature of projection and film, even film projection, right? So it becomes a way of thinking about, how these correspondences are useful for thinking about larger problems and questions rather than the fact of correspondence, I guess is the simple point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, and
And
I mean,
the
oh, sorry, go ahead, Joe.
go ahead, go ahead. No, no,
No,
go
I was
ahead,
just
go
going to
ahead.
say, I mean, that method leads to some really amazing insights. I mean, I'm thinking about the reading of Okja in particular and the way in which, in all of its parodic digital unreality, this CGI pig becomes a kind of allegorical double for the GMO, the, genetically modified.
I mean, those
It
are the
works.
two. The monster, the monsters are the monstrous are the places where this is most obvious. So not just the pig in Okja, but also the monster in The Host, right? And in both cases, I think the allegory is overdetermined. On the one hand, it's the monster in The Host is U.S. Empire, right? But it's also about the problem of hunger. runs the gamut from these poor kids like stealing food to survive all the way to, a hegemonic empire, the hunger of a hegemonic empire. And those are very different modalities, but I think those are both contained within the sort of allegorical figure of the monster. And similarly for Okja, right, you get I think of Okja like I can't I can't not think about what it looked like to film it. So he used these giant like puppets, like and there's like people running around with this giant pig puppet to film it because he wanted to get reactions, for the actors. And it's like the classic green screen, like tennis ball, like look at the tennis ball. So, similar kind of strategy, but the fact, I mean, there was a fairly elaborate puppet that was kind of deployed. And so like there's something about allegory that's sort of built into the production process there, right? That's sort of like, we all know that this isn't the thing that it stands for, right? But we're supposed to behave as if it is. And that has like all sorts of really kind of fascinating resonances, and particularly in that movie, which is all about genetically engineered, food, right? That there's a kind of weird and interesting kind of confluence between the idea of genetic engineering when it comes to food sourcing and CGI, right? And CGI has always been like a weird, and CGI itself is like a weird thing for Bong Joon-ho because, like, and until like later in his career, I think probably maybe he's even as late as Parasite, CGI really means relying on outsourcing, like CGI for the host was done through a U.S. company. So there's that question of sovereignty is not just a, like a political question; it's also a kind of production question. So I guess the point being that there's a way in which allegory for and what's interesting about allegory for Bong Joon-ho is that they become a ne it be they become a sort of nexus for a lot of different ideas that are kind of shot through well beyond the fact of correspondence.
That's great. I want to make sure that we chat a little bit about or hear a little bit about the process of the interview. We always hope with CFD volumes that they'll come with an original interview. They don't always, they can be difficult. Yours does, and it's excellent. It's a really robust interview, and it was clearly an interview that Bong appreciated. And I think you were very smart in your way of basically just not asking him the same questions that everyone was asking him about Parasite, and finding a way to get to some of the questions and concerns that most interest you in your book without, kind of overdetermining a reading of Bong through, the sort of critical or scholarly terms that may or may not have any resonance for him. So I just wonder if you'd say a little bit more about that process of maybe what surprised you most about Bong's answers. You've already talked a little bit about the discussion about maps, but did that process put any kind of pressure on your own reading or your own scholarly or critical frames? And then sort of semi-relatedly, I saw on social media, Joe, that then you were able to meet Bong in person later, and I wanted to hear a
Yes,
little bit
yes.
about that, if you're willing to talk to us about it.
Yeah, that was really, I'm so grateful for that opportunity. It was really a kind of an amazing experience, not least because he's an incredibly generous and lovely person. The interview took a really, really long time because, we had professional translation sort of built into it. And he asked for a break at one point, but I think like we spent like 3.5 hours or something like that. It was a and he wait I he answered every single question. I actually was planning on just getting through as much as I could and then just building something out of that, but he ac actually outlasted me. Like he in some way I wish I'd prepared even more questions. So that was really, really lovely. A couple surprises. I wrote about this in the opening framing. He came in like in pain because he had been writing too hard. He had like injured himself writing. And I can't remember if this is in the interview or not, but he said that, obviously he thinks of himself as a film director, but in terms of like the time spent, he spends way more time writing than he does, being a director, which I thought was really Really, really interesting. The thing that surprised me, I think I mentioned earlier about the sort of very simplistic schema that I had of moving from local to global and then a kind of synthesis in Parasite. He said at one point, I was working on those three movies at the same time. Like
Oh
they're,
yeah, I remember that.
so I mean, I think that schema is still useful in a lot of ways because it's driven not necessarily by his own creative process. It's also driven by the sort of, the market appeal of his projects, right? The circulation of his projects, the various kinds of partnerships with, Hollywood, agents and things like that. But it made me think more about like the sort of through lines and continuities, than, it made me complicate my own sense of that kind of trajectory. But two things, two might sort of, if I indulge me for a second, two of my favorite moments in the interview was one talking about Memories of Murder, and specifically in 20, I wrote this down, 2019, the murderer was actually discovered. So many years after the filming had finished, right, and the film was out in the world or whatever. I remember I was in Seoul when I was in Seoul walking around trying to find breakfast, and I sat down at this sort of empty restaurant. The TV was on, and they said they found the killer. And I was like, my jaw hit the ground, and I'll never forget just sitting there watching this news report. And Bong Joon had a similar kind of reaction, and in fact, called up members of the cast and talked about their feelings. And the thing that was so amazing to me and strange was how much that resonated with the final scene of Memories of Murder, where the detective goes and the detective has stopped being a detective. He's like a juice salesman, right? And he goes back to the scene of the first crime and sort of, like talks to a young girl there who may have seen the killer, right? And it was this weird sort of echo of that cinematic moment in this recounting his experience. And then he decided not to do anything. He was thinking about maybe visiting the killer, but then he decided not to, sort of like let it go, much in the same way that the detective seems to, right? The other really surprising thing was, and I'm still trying to get my head around this, and this actually inspired the thing about the snow at the very end of the book. We're talking about Lee Isaac Chung's Minari and how he had interviewed Lee Isaac Chung and admired the fire scenes, and that he talked about Bong Joon-ho talked about how much he wanted to how much he enjoyed the challenge of dealing with water in his films, that he really wanted to kind of like almost have a mastery over these kind of elements, film elements, including water, right? That was the moment where he felt most authorial, right?
Well, let me jump in since it picks up on what you were just saying. This is Josh speaking. It picks up on what you were just saying about the interview and about the kind of the water and the mud that you're talking about with him there.
Yeah.
That I was reading through that again this morning, and it was like a really just fascinating kind of conversation you were having. Just to say overall too, like I found the book just absolutely illuminating and a pleasure to read through.
Thank you.
But I wanted to ask about water and about the kind of sensory experience of it, and to go back to one of the kind of underlying methodologies that you have here about mise-en-scène and mise-en-abîme. And it struck me that, the water and the kind of conversation about water and the mud and also the snow really kind of gets to the ways in which those concepts are both distinct and also interrelated. And I was thinking about,
Yeah.
filming water and the kind of reflections that come out of water in various ways. And thinking about your discussion of the ending of Parasite 2 about the snow and the mirror reflections there, it strikes me that there's something both material and grounded in the mise-en-scène and his interest in kind of capturing those kinds of elements, but also the kind of reflective nature takes us back into the mise-en-abîme.
Yeah, and I hadn't thought of it in these terms until you sort of articulated it in the way you did. But he's such a famously controlled director. I mean, he storyboards entire movies, and the storyboards for Parasite were actually published, and they're pretty true to the final product, right? He's got a very clear vision of minute details, right? But water is, I think, maybe part of the appeal of water, and hearing you speak about it in those terms makes me think that is the fact that it's so uncontrollable. I don't think he has like a theory of globalization, right? I don't think he has like a message about globalization, right? But I think he does want his films to kind of experience the messiness of it, and that like the treatments of water, snow, and these other kind of natural elements get at that in some kind of way.
Thank you again, Joe, for your willingness to talk a little bit more about this amazing book. We're really excited to have it in the series. We're excited to have it out in the world. We look forward to touching base with you again soon.
Thank you so much. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but there's a the Chinese translation of it just came out
I did
a
not
couple
know
of
that.
weeks ago.
Oh, that's
Yeah,
great.
doubled the possible readership globally. But thank you. This has been a wonderful conversation, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about the project.